Your New York weekend is not complete without the Joan Hamburg Show on 77 WABC.
Oh, we have such a good show for you today. I'm really excited. You can listen to Ben Vereen, to Lawrence O'Donnell, to one of the great chefs talking about the Middle East and Israel. We've got a lot going on. And of course, it is practically Thanksgiving. And everyone always calls and says, tell me about blowing up the balloons. What's new? What's happening? Well, the balloon, the great balloon inflation, takes place Wednesday, right before Thanksgiving, on the 21st, from 1 to 8 o'clock. Go to the Museum of Natural History, West 77th, between that and West 81st Street, and they come alive. There's a security checkpoint, but you wander along a designated path, and it is so much fun. We all love it. And by the way, no backpacks are allowed, so do not bring it or you're going to be very unhappy. And the parade, of course, people come from all over. 77th and Central Park West is where it starts, goes on to Central Park South, and heads to 6th Avenue. Enjoy the wonders of the holiday and enjoy the Joan Hamburg Show straight ahead.
From family and flowers to finance and film, this is Joan Hamburg and New York City's Silver Linings, 77 WABC.
Well, we always tell you what's hot and what's happening and what you should take advantage of. And I'm really excited because the one and only Ben Vereen is in the studio and just right in front of us. He's stepping out with Ben Vereen. He's going to be at the Cutting Room and doing two Thanksgiving shows, one on November 22nd and on the 23rd. And Ben, if that isn't enough, he's heading to the Ridgefield Playhouse in Connecticut, where, believe it or not, Ben is celebrating Hanukkah and doing a song. Now, where'd that come from?
You know, I won the Israeli Cultural Award.
I remember.
Yeah, some years ago. And I sang the song. It was choreographed. And who taught me the song was a choreographer named Rob Iskoff. And it was the celebration. He said, we got to do a song. I want to do a song about I want to do a Hebrew song. So he taught me the song. And we did I think it's called a Hora.
Right, dance. Of course.
We did the dance. And next thing I know, I get a call from Washington that they wanted to give me the Israeli Cultural Award.
Oh, my gosh.
So thank you. Thank you, Israel.
And we love that. And Ben Vereen, you know, even before this aspect of life, is a major Broadway star. And
thank
Wicked
you.
And Jesus Christ Superstar.
Thank you.
And Pippin. Everywhere. In fact, Pippin was probably life-changing for you, although it wasn't your first show.
No. Actually, my first show for Broadway was Jesus Christ Superstar.
Right.
And that was
just
with
a
Tom
wee boy.
Morgan. And then when working with him was amazing. He did Hair and all those shows.
You know. And saw you in Jelly's Last Jam.
Yes.
And
A
Christmas
yes.
Carol.
George Wolfe, thank you very much. And
exactly.
Bob Fosse, thank you very much.
Bob Fosse, one of
Hal
the greats.
Prince,
and
thank
your
you
guy.
Very much, yes.
And what about all the TV you're doing even now?
Yes. I just worked with Dwayne Clark, Dick Clark's son. We shot Magnum P.I.
Yeah,
it was wonderful. He's an amazing director.
I'm excited.
And so was,
you know,
so am I.
Because we watched him come of age.
Yes, didn't we?
You know, so it's a really interesting time. And not only Magnum, there's a series, which you guys know, called Star, with Queen Latifah and Brandy.
And Brandy,
and
I played
Ben.
Their father.
Was
and
that fun?
And LaBelle is my wife.
Oh, you're kidding. Not bad, right? Nothing
Not
like
bad
TV.
Company.
Not I
bad
love
company.
All that. So how do you have time? You're doing, you know, when you walked in and one of the kids who works here, I said, this man does a zillion things before breakfast. He's just constantly moving. And that's been your motto.
It is my motto. It's, you know, like I say, my godmother once said, we were talking about this. She said, when I die and meet God, I want God to look at me and say, you didn't rust out of life. You worked out of life.
which is great.
I have a dance teacher. His name was Luigi. Luigi said, never stop moving. Never stop moving. That was his mantra.
But even if it hurts you, like we were kidding about bionic men and women, you know, that everything, everyone's got replaceable parts.
Replaceable parts, I like that.
Even if it hurts you, you still move, right?
Because the spirit within knows nothing about that. And it says, get up, you can do this and move on.
And you do it.
Then we do it.
But a Brooklyn boy.
Yes, yes. Hello, Brooklyn. I miss you.
Well, Brooklyn now. Who can afford to go to Brooklyn, right?
Exactly.
So tell me, you grew up in Brooklyn, but you didn't know you were going to be Ben Vereen, at that point. It was a whole different mindset.
Yes. It was a completely different mindset. You're growing up, you're a kid, the streets, running the streets. You're singing in churches. You're running with gangs. And then one day a principal says, go to the high school for the performing arts. You meet a principal
I
did go and auditioned. And the reason why I got in is because of a woman named Rachel Yoakum, who was the dance department. And her partner was a woman named Rachel, Gertrude Scher. And she was my modern dance teacher, David Woods. I had some wonderful training at the High School of Performing Arts on 46th Street.
But you had the gift.
Yes.
It wasn't just the school and that you were an artistic kid.
Mm-hmm.
You knew. And I think you once told me it was your godmother who took you to church to sing.
That's right, she did. She found me playing on the streets on Herkimer Street when I was about, 6 years old. And she said, you need to be in church. She took me to church.
And you went. Not every kid would have gone.
I went, and she taught me to sing.
And
my first song.
So when you were graduated from the performing arts,
yes,
what happened? Did you start auditioning? What was the dream of Ben Vereen?
I never really thought about the business because my family weren't theater goers.
They were workers. Of course, who could afford it?
Well, in those days, you could. But, we were in Brooklyn, and Brooklyn was our world. Brooklyn Dodgers, yes, when they were in Brooklyn.
Exactly, that was the deal.
And so I never thought about this business. And when it came upon me, it's like a blessing. It's like a blessing. So when I got to the High School Performing Arts and worked with all those fabulous teachers, and on my graduation, a woman named Helen Tamiris gave me a $500 scholarship. And a woman named Vinette Carroll was doing a show called The Prodigal Son off-Broadway at the Greenwich Muse Theater, and she asked me to be in it. And it was written by a guy named Langston Hughes. So that's how I got started.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And you were just a kid.
I was a kid. I knew nothing about this world. Matter of fact, I had never been to Harlem. And Langston News brought me to Harlem for the first time.
And Harlem?
In those days,
Harlem is so gentrified. But I went to Barnett. And we would go to the Baby Grand or to any of the bars in Harlem.
Yes.
Because there was so much talent in Harlem. You know, it wasn't full of multi-million dollar condos. You were lucky if you got to the bar. But you heard things you couldn't imagine, right?
Yes, all the music, all the culture. And it still is. It still is there.
Yeah. And a lot of good restaurants, too, now.
Yes.
So your career started taking off just when you were still a young kid.
Yeah, it began taking off. And then, of course, it's Feast of Famine. I did The Prodigal Son,
and then
I ended up doing a summer stop. I came back from summer stop. I was evicted from my apartment. I jumped the turnstile, went to New York City, standing at the newsstand, like I was going to buy a newspaper, which I couldn't afford. It was only a nickel. I couldn't afford it. And I'm reading through the newspaper, and there is an audition at a place called the Palace Theater, when it was the Palace Theater.
Right.
And it was for a show called Sweet Charity, starring Juliet Prowse, going to Las Vegas. I went to that audition and met Bob Fosse. And that's when it all started.
You're kidding. And Bob Fosse took an interest in you?
Bob Fosse saw me and Bob Fosse
What did you remember that audition?
Oh, I can remember
what
like it was yesterday.
What did you do?
We did a dance and then I had to sing. I had to learn the combination. It was like the opening of All That Jazz. I don't know if you've seen the movie That Jazz, but it was like the opening of All That Jazz. And every dancer seemed like in the world was on that stage. And I got elimination, and then finally I made the final cut, and then he asked me to sing. And I had not sang on a Broadway stage in my life. I knew songs
you were
like,
now a
I knew songs like, yes, Jesus loves me. Yes, Jesus loves me. I said, I can't sing that because I'm hearing guys go, Oklahoma, where the sun comes right behind the rain, and I'm going to live till I die. And they had a song called Blue Skies. Blue skies smile at me. And so if you didn't have a song, you sing that song. So I got up and I sang Blue Skies. And Bob stopped in the middle of the aisle, turned around, looked at me, and he said, sing that a cappella. I sang it a cappella, and next thing I know, I was in Sweet Charity.
Wow. Unreal. Yes. When you think back of all the things that happened in your life.
I was, you know, it's funny. I was just thinking about that coming up in the elevator. I said, yeah, I really have to write a book. I keep talking about it, but I've got to write the book because some of the wonderful memories I have, the wonderful, warm, beautiful people who've touched my life. I mean, Flip Wilson, come on.
Oh,
you know, I have people like that. I mean, I got to play Louis Armstrong, Chicago style, and to get into that whole mindset. I got to, the people that have come through, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Shirley MacLaine,
Lena
Horne, Tony Walton, people like this. These are people that have, I mean, that's just a scratch on the surface that this world has allowed me to see. This entertainment world has allowed me to see. I'm a true believer in the arts. I'm an adequate advocate for the arts.
And you've done that for kids, too.
Yes, it's important that we keep the legacy going. But we must understand something, that life itself is an art form. Mine is the performing art form. Yours is the communication art form. Medicine art form. Street cleaning art form. But when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you got to realize, that's the miracle.
It is the miracle. Could your family believe what was happening to their Brooklyn boy?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, my mother always did.
Did she sing, by the way?
No, she didn't sing. My mother was a garment presser in a factory. My father also worked in a paint factory. So they knew nothing about the theater, but she knew she wanted something better for her son. And so she would push me to go to these dance classes, pushed me to
she
go.
Knew.
And she ended up, we ended up at my first major concert, which was at before High School of Performing Arts. I'll never forget her sitting in the audience.
And the
bring a tear to my eye.
No, but for your parent to see all that effort and know that it was okay.
And what was so great was that I remember the first time my father came to see me in Jesus Christ Superstar,
which was a big
big show, and he had never been to the theater, and we had to wear like in one scene I had like briefs on. It was a scene where Judas dies,
right,
and he comes back as an angel, and I have on briefs. So my father comes back backstage, and I said, "Well, Dad, what'd you think of it?" He said, "Boy, you better put some clothes on. You're going to catch cold out there."
So, right, the things that stick in your head.
Stick in your mind.
That were really funny.
Yes.
But as you started with Jesus and then Pippin and one after another, Tony nomination, all kinds of things.
Yes.
You felt secure that you were right on track.
I still don't feel secure.
No,
about being right on track. I'm grateful. I'm in a place of gratitude. As you said, this business is feast or famine. But what makes it wonderful are the fans, the friends
who
embrace me, and I thank them. I love them so much. And I do my shows as a tribute to them.
Ben Vereen. Now, aren't you, in addition to your television roles and everything else, and exactly the wonderful nights coming up, stepping out with Ben Vereen, and that's in The Cutting Room. We're very familiar with The Cutting Room here at WABC because we do a lot of broadcasts from there and a lot of events.
It's a beautiful venue.
Oh, I love The Cutting Room. I used to go all the time.
Amazing.
Because every great comic tries material out there a lot.
Matter of fact, Lenny's playing there right now. They're doing Lenny. a tribute to Lenny.
Right.
And I can't wait to see it myself.
It's great.
And as I told you, I don't know if I mentioned that on Thanksgiving.
You're going to Connecticut.
On Thanksgiving at the Cutting Room, when you come to the show at 5 o'clock, we're having dinner. Gourmet dinner.
Wow.
For Thanksgiving both nights. And the establishment there, Steve, the manager.
Right.
He's giving everyone a free glass of champagne.
Very nice.
To celebrate the holiday.
Very nice. Although the sparkle and the bubble is with the one and only Ben Vereen, who's one of the most versatile entertainers. Broadway shows, the Fox series star coming on. And tell me that I had read about the new Broadway project you're working on, Reflections?
Yeah, Reflections.
Tell me what that is.
Reflections will be a show about my life, about our life. Because for me to stand on stage, though, then I did this and then I did that, that's boring to me. But I want to do a show that reflects our time, the time that I grew up in and what was going on. You got to understand, in my lifetime, the greats, you know, the greats, the people who, let's talk about John F. Kennedy. Let's talk about Martin Luther King. Let's talk about Gandhi. About all the things, the Vietnam War. All these things are going on in my lifetime. But here's the thing. The arts is what carried me through and carried us all through.
Right. And your belief in it and the magic.
Yes, yes. The magic.
It creates.
Yes, yes.
Well, congratulations
to
you, Ben.
Thank you.
And you may have caught him. He just did a Magnum.
Yes, I did.
Just, I think, last week.
That's right. It was great.
It was very exciting. Now Star, now holiday shows. Mm-hmm. If you want to hear the great Ben Vereen do a Yiddish version or a Hebrew version of a Hanukkah song, then you've got to take yourself to New Jersey.
Yes, yes, up to Connecticut. You got
to
come
to Connecticut. Right.
Because also I'll be doing Kwanzaa, we'll be doing Christmas.
I'm not going to miss a beat.
And also, at the show, I'll be selling my hats, the Spiritual Enforcer hats will be on sale. The product proceeds will go towards the schools and helping keep the arts alive. And Ram Dass has made me the Minister of Fun.
That's your hat.
That's my hat. And as I say, once again, if it's not fun, don't do it. And if you got to do it, make it fun.
And that's Ben Vereen. The Cutting Room is 44 East 32nd Street. Go to thecuttingroomnyc.com. And it's a 5 o'clock show. The doors open at 5, and it's a 7:30 show. The tickets are reasonable. You're going to have a yummy dinner, and you're going to really feel
and
grateful.
And get a glass of champagne. Those of you who drink champagne.
Well, why not?
And also a free glass of water.
That's really the big deal. All right. All the best to you. Have a wonderful holiday.
God bless. And to your listeners, have a wonderful holiday. And not only a great holiday, but make every day a wonderful holiday for you and your families. May all you want come to you with great ease, all the good in the world, and God bless you.
And that's a blessing from he who is blessed. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC. More to come.
The headlines, the tabloids, the buzz. Joan Hamburg. Where New York comes to talk. 77 WABC.
I've said that I probably see Lawrence O'Donnell, who is host of MSNBC's The Last Word, more than I see my own husband. It is a nightly occurrence. And not only is Lawrence O'Donnell a host, he was an Emmy Award-winning producer and writer for The West Wing. His recent book, Playing with Fire, the 96 election and the transformation of American politics, is a fascinating read, because how many of you out there keep saying, this is the darkest time we've ever had? Well, you have to read Playing with Fire. So, Lawrence, 68 and 2018, 17, 18, how do we even compare them?
Well, one is the point that you just referenced, which is that it was a much darker time in 1968. Now, it's been hard for me to convey that to my daughter, who, of course, wasn't around then, but I was a high school kid then, And everyone of my older brothers and their friends was worried about being shipped off to Vietnam to die in a war that they did not understand and were opposed to. And in 1968 alone, over 16,000 American lives were lost in Vietnam, and many, many more lives lost on the other side of the war in Vietnam. And so there wasn't a person who didn't feel in some way threatened by that war. If it wasn't you, it was your brother or your cousin or your boyfriend or your uncle. And so there was a fear. There was a very live fear of one's own life that was at stake at that time. This is a different kind of darkness, and this is a kind that we've never seen before. But the feeling, the gut feeling about it, is very, very similar to what we felt in 1968.
And, of course, the cast of characters and what went on there. Everything in the Democratic Party, the upheavals, the assassination of RFK, and Richard Nixon playing the game that he knew how to play better than almost anyone else.
Well, yeah, I mean, almost any event in the 1968 campaign would have been the biggest event in any other campaign. For example, Gene McCarthy goes up to New Hampshire and challenges the president of his own party in primaries. That had never happened before. A Democrat running against a Democratic president.
Turns on his own.
Before. Yeah, followed by Bobby Kennedy jumping in. Then you have the Martin Luther King assassination, which would have been the biggest event by far to impact a political campaign. But that's followed just weeks later by Bobby Kennedy's assassination. Lyndon Johnson, the sitting president, dropping out of his own reelection campaign, just giving up. Which is the reason why some people today wonder if Donald Trump, under certain kinds of pressures, might just give up on his own reelection campaign. The only reason people wonder that is we saw it happen once before.
I know, but do you wonder that?
Sure, I do. Absolutely. The Lyndon Johnson was a much, much tougher man, stronger man, tougher politician, smarter politician, more powerful politician than Donald Trump has ever been in his life. And Lyndon Johnson gave up. And so if Lyndon Johnson can give up on reelection, then there's no telling what might happen. And so there are plenty of lessons like that in 1968 that are relevant to the way we look at our situation today.
Right, but even then, as dark as it was with everything that was going on, we didn't have a president that turned his vicious anger on the press.
No, but that's a relatively minor, you know, that's just a show. That's just a performance thing. There's no real harm done in that. And in fact, it only gives the press more
power.
It just brings more attention to the press. No one has been as stupid. And the thing to remember about Donald Trump, the key word that is often neglected in the coverage of Donald Trump, is how incredibly rank stupid the man is. And so he does damage to himself every single day. And people make the mistake of thinking what he does not harm himself simply because he still has the job. You have it. The job has a term to it. You know, of course he has the job. You have the job for 4 years. But Donald Trump has harmed himself with every one of these crazy things that, you know, that he has done publicly, and that's why he lost the midterm elections, and that's why he's never converted a voter his side since he became president, and he's been so stupid he hasn't even tried to.
Well, and as you point out, this is, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but one of the strangest times, not as maybe as dark as 68 in many ways, but still, even Mrs. Trump, when we see now the former First Lady on tour with her new book, and then we see Mrs. Trump, again, a turning on what could be considered their own, which we very rarely hear First Ladies attack.
No, it's not very rarely. Melania Trump has done things that no other first lady has ever done, and the press always wants to couch this in very rarely.
Mm-hmm.
No, she just tried to fire somebody publicly, without any without the person actually being fired by the president. She tried to assume the powers of the presidency publicly. No spouse of the president has ever done that before. Sure, there have been some powerful wives of the president who have advised the president in the background about who to hire or who to fire or what to change. Of course, that's been there. But they've all been very professional about it and very careful about it. And they didn't try to seize the president's power publicly as Melania Trump did.
Yeah, amazing. You talk about Ronald Reagan. By the way, if you've just joined us, Lawrence O'Donnell talking about his new book, Playing with Fire, involves the 1968 election. And all of that time comes back to life, and it was a turbulent, we have to remember Vietnam and all the anger and the assassination. What about President Reagan during those times? Did I hear you say at one point he was the Donald Trump of the 60s?
It's, in many ways, he was. Since he came from television into politics, he was regarded as lightweight as Donald Trump was regarded at the beginning. And Ronald Reagan actually made a move to try to snatch the Republican nomination away from Richard Nixon at the convention. Ronald Reagan really was the darling right away of the right wing of the Republican Party, and was a very charismatic figure. And so he came alarmingly close for Nixon of just snatching that nomination away from him. But, of course, he was on his way, on playing a longer game, of getting that Republican nomination and eventually the presidency. But we saw his first moves on that, and they were really good inside moves, I have to say, in 1968.
Lawrence O'Donnell, as a kid, became fascinated with this time in history and continued all the way through. I always get the feeling, no matter what, that you are still the optimist, really believing in the system. Are you positive at all? We came apart in the 60s. We're certainly coming apart in many ways. At this point in time, can Humpty Dumpty be put back together again?
Yeah, well, I'm much more positive now than I was in 1968, and when we were in the middle of a war, and I was going to my first military funeral, and my cousin was killed in Vietnam. Much more positive about it. I think basically everything that's gone wrong can be rectified with our elections. We're on the way to that. Donald Trump just resoundingly lost the midterm elections. All the indicators are that he's on his way to losing again 2 years from now. He needed, as president, as all presidents do, he needed to convert people who did not vote for him. He has not converted one, and that means that the Democrat, whoever the Democrat is still on track to win at least 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, and it will not be difficult for the Democrat to put together the right electoral college formula to correct some of those campaign errors that the Clinton campaign made at the last minute in Wisconsin and Michigan.
I'm talking to Lawrence O'Donnell, the last word on MSNBC, his new book, Playing with Fire. Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Joan Hamburg. You're listening to WABC.
From food to fun and so much more, The Joan Hamburg Show, exclusively on 77 WABC.
Well, hi there, everyone. And we love talking about food and a beautiful new book, which I'm so happy to say was produced by one of my friends, Dorothy Kalins, called Israeli Soul, is not only gorgeous, but it makes you want to make absolutely everything. And it's a fabulous travelogue, too. You go through Israel. Michael Solomonoff is one of the mainstays behind this book with Stephen Cook. And Michael is the executive chef of Zahav, the 2017 James Beard Outstanding Chef in America, and the 2016 Eater chef of the world. So congratulations for everything. And talk to me about Israeli Soul, your gorgeous new book.
Oh, well, thank you so much, first of all, for having me on, and thank you for the lovely compliments. I think, so we came out with a book a few years ago called Zahav.
Uh-huh.
And then it was the history of Israel, it was the history of my family or my relationship to the country, and it was like the sort of the walking people through opening this Israeli restaurant in Pennsylvania. And so everything was shot through the prism or through the lens of this restaurant in Philadelphia. And what we wanted to do with Israeli Soul is take people to Israel and travel, basically, and eat and immerse themselves in what we find to be really the sort of stimulating and exciting place and country and multiple cultures and so many different tables and kiosks and all the different food that gets us excited about Israel. So that's what Israeli Soul is about. And we took your friend Dorothy Kalins, who's my friend, who I love, who's been to Israel a couple times, but it was really Dorothy and Don Morris who did our layout, Michael Persico, who's the photographer. We just wanted to bring everybody to Israel and essentially just shoot food, and that's what happened.
Right, and it's such a fabulous food culture because it combines so many different cultures, and as you point out, these recipes, many of them, go back for generations.
Yeah.
And yet you can make them as a home cook. And it's hard to, like you point out, which is true, everyone thinks Israeli food, oh, falafel. But that's
not
only
all,
one,
yeah.
Right? One tiny part. It's everything. Most people
the
wouldn't even know.
Right, exactly. And that was sort of the source of contention with us when we opened the restaurant. We didn't want it to be cliched. We didn't want it to only be like sandwiches or like pita sandwiches. And, you know, falafel is wonderful and Israelis have marketed it very well, but it obviously doesn't come from Israel. It's not it's Israeli by sort of by association. So, but what we wanted to do is really celebrate, and we do this in our restaurant, but we do this with the book, is really celebrate this convergence of so many different cuisines and cultures and gastronomies, dating from, you know, we're talking about sort of in the diaspora and Palestinian cuisine and Levantine cuisine, sort of highlighted by the Druze in the north, and Balkan food and European food, and really the sort of melting pot of what Israel is.
Right, and you point out when you say Israeli Soul, it could be a sandwich called savish. Well, amazing how many people had no clue about this, and how you even talk about a hard-boiled egg is a whole different thing.
Well, and also like the fact that, you know, sabich was created in Israel by an Iraqi Israeli, but the dish stems from tabit, which is this sort of overnight sort of casserole, which every Jewish culture has, because, you know, on Fridays you gotta not mess with the oven after sundown till Saturday for Shabbat, right? Which is what makes it kind of relevant. It's not just Iraqi food from Iraq, it's Iraqi food brought to Israel by the Jews, right? So there's guidelines like kashrut, there are the guidelines of cooking like the Sabbath, which happens once a week, you know? So sabich was created in Israel in the 60s by an Iraqi Jew who took all the ingredients that were in tabit, pulled them out, and as a snack, stuffed them inside of a pita. Hence, you know, and then the sort of fantastic, the star of a sandwich was born. And those are the stories that we really want to capture. Those are the things that help really identify what Israeli food is, not just food in the Middle East, not just Jewish, not just, certainly not just Jewish or kosher, but not also just, I think that being able to celebrate all these different cultures and the history of the way that the food either got or remained in now Israel, I think is really what makes it special and what makes the cuisine and the sort of observation on culture, but through cuisine, is so unique.
Right. And I'm curious, in your restaurant, Zahav, what is there one dish that is so popular that everyone wants it?
Yeah, we've actually got a lamb shoulder that we cure and smoke and confit in chicken fat, and then we glaze it with pomegranate molasses. Mm,
is that the one in the book?
That's the one in Zahav, yep.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds delish.
It's really good. You have to come in and have it. It's delicious.
I would love that. And also the way you deal with eggplant, that sort of paper thin, and you know how certain places in Israel, if eggplant is included as part of what you're eating on a sandwich and you don't order it, they're not going to make the sandwich.
Oh, yeah, that's it. I know. Well, eggplant is the star, and eggplant is delicious and wonderful. It gets sort of a bad rap here. I mean, it's getting a little bit better, I think, now in the States, but it's really it's amazing. And actually, at our restaurant, one of our entrees is lamb cooked on charcoal, and that's, you know, and it's a vegan dish, but I mean, I would say like 30% of the customers order it.
Well, it just sounds perfect. And here, a lot of New Yorkers will go have a shawarma in some of these restaurants. And after reading your book, I thought, I'm not doing that again till I have the real thing. Who knows how long it's been twirling around that window.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
And very popular.
I think you need to come down and bring the show and bring yourself down to Zahav and eat, you know. We'd love to have you.
Well, we'd love to do that, too. And after reading this glorious book, you can actually do this at home. And you've made it fairly simple to do this, whether it is falafel, whether it's homemade pita, or schnitzel, or any of the grilled things.
Yeah, definitely. That was sort of the deal. We wanted to travel through the country and really capture all the things that were important to us, but really be able to translate it to the home cook to make it easy. And we cooked everything. In the book, all the process shots were shot in my one-bedroom apartment with
kidding.
Yeah, really not a cool kitchen. I know that's ironic because I'm a chef.
Yeah, but it's okay.
My home kitchen was a step higher than a college dormitory.
No, but I love the stories, too. When your dad took you to Israel, and, you know, it was so much about the food and about the taste and how life-changing it was for you as a kid.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to, you know, I think that you go through these phases, you know, and my identity was sort of here and there, and for some, you know, whatever reasons, I would sort of be drawn back to it. And in a lot of ways, food was sort of the bridge that got me excited. I mean, my grandmother, who I was very close to, did not speak English. My Hebrew has never been that great. And her cooking and feeding and nourishing and passing down something that was important to her, something that she grew up with, like these borekas and these like Balkan pastries that came from like medieval Spain. Yeah, I mean, that is the way for her to continue this, you know, it's sort of got this door of a door, like, consideration in which we, you know, as Jews, but really just as humans, interact with one another. And I think that is so relevant. And to be able to share that with a reader is amazing.
Well, and not only is the food delicious, but the stories are wonderful. It's literally not as good as going to Israel, but it comes pretty close. Israeli Soul by Michael Solomonoff and Stephen Cook. And if you've ever been to Philly, you know their restaurant is a James Beard Award winner, Zaha. Thank you so much. All the best to you, Michael. I look forward to seeing you in Pennsylvania.
Enjoy.
Absolutely. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC. Stay tuned.